remove the pain, expel the pain, I might well make a contribution of some size, some considerable size, what I believe you people call a love offering.
That would be your business, sir. Shall we begin?
No time like the present. Do you want everyone to leave?
Rideout shook his head again, left to right, right to left, back to center.
I will need assistance.
Magicians always do, Cat thought. It's part of the show.
Outside, the wind shrieked, rested, then roused itself again. The lights flickered. Behind the house, the generator, also state-of-the-art, burped to life, then stilled. Rideout sat on the edge of the bed.
Mr. Jensen there, I think. He looks strong and quick.
He's both, Newsom said. Played football in college, running back, hasn't lost a step since.
Well, a few, Jensen said modestly.
Rideout leaned toward Newsom. His dark, deeply socketed eyes studied the billionaire's scarred face solemnly.
Answer a question for me, sir. What color is your pain?
Green,
Newsom replied. He was looking back at the preacher with fascination.
My pain is green.
Rideout nodded, up, down, back to center, eye contact never lost. Cat was sure he would have nodded with exactly the same look of grave confirmation if Newsom had said his pain was blue or as purple as the fabled people-eater. She thought with some combination of dismay and real amusement, I could lose my temper here. I really could. It would be the most expensive tantrum of my life, but still I could.
And where is it?
Everywhere.
It was almost a moan. Melissa took a step forward, giving Jensen a look of concern. Cat saw him shake his head a little and motion her back to the doorway.
Yes, it likes to give that impression, Rideout said, but it's a liar. Close your eyes, sir, and concentrate. Look for the pain. Look past the false shouts it gives. Ignore the cheap ventriloquism and locate it. You can do this. You must do it if we're to have any success.
Newsom closed his eyes. For a space of about 90 seconds, there was no sound but the wind and the rain spattering against the windows like handfuls of fine gravel. Cat's watch was the old-fashioned wind-up kind, a nursing school graduation present from her father many years ago, and when the wind lulled, the room was quiet enough for her to hear its self-important ticking. And something else. At the far end of the big house, elderly Tanya Marsden singing softly as she neatened up the kitchen at the end of another day.
Froggy went a-courtin' and he did right, uh-huh.
At last Newsom said,
It's in my chest, high in my chest, or at the bottom of my throat below the windpipe.
Can you see it? Concentrate.
Vertical lines appeared on Newsom's forehead. Scars from the skin that had been flayed open during the accident wavered through these grooves of concentration.
I see it. It's pulsing, in time to my heartbeat.
His lips pulled down in an expression of distaste.
It's nasty.
Rideout leaned closer.
Is it a ball? It is, isn't it? A green ball. Yes, yes. A little green ball that breathes.
Like the rigged-up tennis ball you undoubtedly have either up your sleeve or in that big black lunchbox of yours, Rev, she thought.
And as if she were controlling him with her mind, instead of just deducing where this foolish little playlet would go next, Rideout said,
Mr. Jensen, sir, there's a lunchbox under the chair I was sitting in. Get it and open it and stand next to me. You need to do no more than that for the moment. Just...
Cat MacDonald snapped. It was a snap she actually heard in her head,
It sounded like Roger Miller snapping his fingers during the intro to King of the Road. She stepped up beside Rideout and shouldered him aside. It was easy. He was taller, but she had been turning and lifting patients for nearly half her life, and she was stronger. "Open your eyes, Andy. Open them right now. Look at me." Startled, Newsom did as she said. Melissa and Jensen, now with a lunchbox in his hands, looked alarmed. One of the facts of their working lives, and Kat's own, at least until now, was that you didn't command the boss. The boss commanded you. You most certainly did not startle him. But she'd had quite enough. In another 20 minutes, she might be crawling after her headlights along stormy roads to the only motel in the vicinity. But it didn't matter. She simply couldn't do this any longer. "This is bullshit, Andy," she said. "Are you hearing me? Bullshit!"
"I think you'd better stop right there," Newsom said, beginning to smile.
He had several smiles, and this wasn't one of the good ones.
"If you want to keep your job, that is. There are plenty of other nurses in Vermont who specialize in pain therapy."
She might have stopped there, but Rideout said, "Let her speak, sir." It was the gentleness in his tone that drove her over the edge. She leaned forward into his space, and the words spilled out in a torrent. "For the last 16 months, ever since your respiratory system improved enough to allow meaningful physiotherapy, I've watched you lie in this goddamn expensive bed and insult your own body. It makes me sick. Do you know how lucky you are to be alive when everyone else on that airplane was killed? What a miracle it was that your spine wasn't severed, or your skull crushed into your brain, or your body burned? No, baked. Baked like an apple from head to toe. You would have lived for days, maybe even 2 weeks in hellish agony. Instead, you were thrown clear. You're not a vegetable. You're not a quadriplegic, although you choose to act like one. You won't do the work. You look for some easier way. You want to pay your way out of your situation. If you died and went to hell, the first thing you'd try to do is grease Satan's palm." Jensen and Melissa were staring at her in horror. Newsom's mouth hung open. If he had ever been talked to in such a fashion, it had been long ago. Only Rideout looked at ease. He was the one smiling now, the way a father would smile at his wayward 4-year-old. It drove her crazy.
"You could have been walking by now. God knows I've tried to make you understand that, and God knows I've told you over and over the kind of work it would take to get you up out of that bed and back on your feet. Dr. Dilawar in San Francisco had the guts to tell you. He was the only one, and you rewarded him by calling him a faggot."
"He was a faggot," Newsom said.
His scarred hands had balled themselves into fists.
"You're in pain, yes, of course you are. It's manageable, though. I've seen it managed. Not once, but many times. Not by a rich man who tries to substitute his sense of entitlement for the plain old hard work and tears it takes to get better. You refuse. I've seen that, too, and I know what always happens next. The quacks and confidence men come, the way leeches come when a man with a cut leg wades into a stagnant pond. Sometimes the quacks have magic creams. Sometimes they have magic pills. The healers come with trumped-up claims about God's power, the way this one has. Usually the marks get partial relief. Why wouldn't they, when half the pain is in their heads, manufactured by lazy minds that only understand it will hurt to get better?"
She raised her voice to a wavering, childlike treble and bent close to him.
"Daddy, it hurts!"
"But the relief never lasts long because the muscles have no tone. The tendons are still slack. The bones haven't thickened enough to accommodate weight-bearing. And when you get this guy on the phone to tell him the pain's back, if you can, do you know what he'll say?
That you didn't have faith enough.
If you used your brains on this the way you did on your manufacturing plants and various investments, you'd know there's no living tennis ball sitting at the base of your throat. You're too fucking old to believe in Santa Claus, Andy."
Tanya had come into the doorway and now stood beside Melissa, staring with wide eyes and a dish wiper hanging limp in one hand.
"You're fired,"
Newsom said, almost genially.
"Yes," Kat said. "Of course I am. Although I must say that this is the best I've felt in almost a year."
"If you fire her," Rideout said, "I'll have to take my leave."
Newsom's eyes rolled to the Reverend. His brow was knitted in perplexity. His hands now began to knead his hips and thighs, as they always did when his pain medication was overdue.
"She needs educating. Praise God's holy name."
Rideout leaned toward Newsom, his own hands clasped behind his back. He reminded Kat of a picture she'd seen once of Washington Irving's school teacher, Ichabod Crane.
"She's had her say. Shall I have mine?"
Newsom was sweating more heavily, but he was smiling again.
"Have at her. Rip and roar. I believe I want to hear this."
Kat faced him. Those dark, socketed eyes were unsettling, but she met them.
"Actually, so do I."
Hands still clasped behind his back, pink skulls shining mutedly through his thin hair, long face solemn, Rideout examined her. Then he said,
"You've never suffered yourself, have you?"
Kat felt an urge to flinch at that, or look away, or both. She suppressed it.
"I fell out of a tree when I was 11 and broke my arm."
Rideout rounded his thin lips and whistled, one tuneless, almost toneless note.
"Broken arm while you were 11. Yes, that must have been excruciating."
She flushed. She felt it and hated it, but couldn't stop the heat.
"Belittle me all you want. I based what I said on years of experience dealing with pain patients. It is medical opinion."
Now he'll tell me he's been expelling demons or little green gods or whatever they are since I was in rompers. But he didn't.
"I'm sure,"
he soothed.
"I'm sure you're good at what you do. I'm sure you've seen your share of fakers and posers. You know their kind. And I know yours, miss, because I've seen it many times before. They're not usually as purty as you."
Finally, a trace of an accent, pretty coming out as purty.
"But their condescending attitude toward pain they have never felt themselves. Pain they can't even conceive of is always the same. They work in sick rooms. They work with patients who are in varying degrees of distress, from mild pain to deepest, searing agony. And after a while, it all starts to look either overdone or outright fake to them, isn't that so?"
"That's not true at all," Kat said.
What was happening to her voice? All at once it had grown small.
"No. When you bend their legs and they scream at 15 degrees or even at 10, don't you think first in the back of your mind, then more and more toward the front, that they are lollygagging, refusing to do the hard work, perhaps even fishing for sympathy? When you enter the room and their faces go pale, don't you think, oh, now I have to deal with this lazy slug of a thing again? Haven't you, once fell from a tree and broke your arm, for the Lord's sake, become more and more disgusted when they beg to be put back into bed and given more morphine or whatever?"
"That's so unfair,"
Kat said, but now her voice was little more than a whisper.
"Once upon a time, when you were new at this, you knew agony when you saw it," Rideout said. "Once upon a time you would have believed in what you are going to see in just a few minutes, because you knew in your heart that a malignant outsider was there. I want you to stay so I can refresh your memory and the sense of compassion that's gotten lost along the way."
"Some of my patients are whiners," Kat said, and looked defiantly at Newsom. "I suppose that sounds cruel, but sometimes the truth is cruel. Some are malingerers. If you don't know that, you're blind or stupid,
I don't think you're either. He bowed as if she had paid him a compliment, which, in a way, she supposed she had.
Of course I know. But now, in your secret heart, you believe all of them are malingerers. Like a soldier who spent too long in battle, you've become inured. Mr. Newsome is invaded. I tell you, infested. There's a demon inside him so strong, it has become a god, and I want you to see it when it comes out. It will improve matters for you considerably, I think. Certainly, it will change your outlook on pain.
And if I choose to leave?
Rideout smiled.
No one will hold you here, Miss Nurse. Like all of God's creatures, you have free will. I would not ask others to constrain it or constrain it myself. But I don't believe you're a coward. Merely calloused. Case hardened.
You're a fraud, Cat said. She was furious, on the verge of tears.
No,
Rideout said, once more speaking gently.
When we leave this room, with or without you, Mr. Newsome will be relieved of the agony that's been feeding on him. There will still be pain, but with the agony gone, he'll be able to deal with mere pain. Perhaps even with your help, miss, once you've had a necessary lesson in humility. Do you still intend to leave?
I'll stay, she said, then said, give me the lunchbox.
But,
Jensen began.
Give it over, Rideout said. Let her inspect it, by all means, but no more talk. If I am meant to do this, it's time to begin.
Jensen gave her the long black lunchbox. Cat opened it. Where a workman's wife might have packed her husband's sandwiches and a little Tupperware container of fruit, she saw an empty glass bottle with a wide mouth. Inside the domed lid, held by a wire clamp meant to secure a thermos, was an aerosol can. There was nothing else. Cat turned to Rideout. He nodded. She took the aerosol out and looked at the label, nonplussed.
Pepper spray?
Pepper spray, Rideout agreed. I don't know if it's legal in Vermont, probably not would be my guess, but where I come from, most hardware stores stock it.
He turned to Tanya.
You are?
Tanya Marsden, I cook for Mr. Newsome.
Very nice to make your acquaintance, ma'am. I need one more thing before we begin. Do you have any sort of club, baseball, bat, perhaps?
Tanya shook her head. The wind gusted again. Once more the lights flickered and the generator burped in its shed behind the house.
What about a broom?
Oh, yes, sir.
Fetch it, please.
Tanya left. There was silence except for the wind. Cat tried to think of something to say and couldn't. Droplets of clear perspiration were trickling down Newsome's narrow cheeks, which had also been scarred in the accident. He had rolled and rolled while the wreckage of the Gulf Stream burned in the rain behind him.
I never said he wasn't in pain, just that he could manage it if he'd only muster half the will he showed during the years he spent building his empire.
But what if she was wrong?
Even if I am, that doesn't mean there's some sort of living tennis ball inside him, sucking his pain the way a vampire sucks blood.
There were no vampires, and no gods of agony. But when the wind blew hard enough to make the big house shiver in its bones, such ideas seemed almost plausible. Tanya came back with a broom that looked like it had never swept so much as a single pile of floor dirt into a dustpan. The bristles were bright blue nylon. The handle was painted wood, about 4 feet long. She held it up doubtfully.
This what you want?
I think it will serve,
Rideout said, although to Cat he didn't sound entirely sure. It occurred to her that Newsome might not be the only one in this room who had slipped a few cogs lately.
I think you better give it to our skeptical nurse. No offense to you, Mrs. Marsden, but younger folks have quicker reflexes.
Looking not offended in the slightest, looking relieved, in fact, Tanya held out the broom. Melissa took it and handed it to Cat.
What am I supposed to do with it? Cat asked. Ride it?
Rideout smiled, briefly showing the stained and eroded pegs of his teeth.
You'll know when the time comes. If you've ever had a bat or a raccoon in the room with you, just remember, first the bristles, then the stick.
To finish it off, I suppose, then you put it in the specimen bottle?
As you say.
So you can put it on a shelf somewhere with the rest of your dead gods?
He didn't respond to this.
Hand the spray can to Mr. Jensen, please.
Cat did so. Melissa asked,
What do I do?
Watch and pray if you know how, on my behalf as well as Mr. Newsom's, for my heart to be strong.
Cat, who saw a fake heart attack coming, said nothing. She simply moved away from the bed, holding the handle of the broom in both hands. Rideout sat down beside Newsom with a grimace. His knees popped like pistol shots.
Listen to me, Mr. Jensen.
Yes?
You'll have time. It will be stunned. But be quick, just the same. As quick as you were on the football field, all right?
You want me to mace it?
Rideout once more flashed his brief smile, but Cat thought he really did look ill.
It's not mace. That's illegal, even where I come from. But you've got the right idea, all right. Now I'd like silence, please.
Wait a minute.
Cat propped the broom against the bed and ran her hands first up Rideout's left arm, then his right. She felt only plain cotton cloth and the man's scrawny flesh beneath.
Nothing up my sleeve, Miss Cat, I promise you.
Hurry up,
Newsom said.
This is bad. It always is, but the goddamn stormy weather makes it worse.
Hush, Rideout said. All of you, hush.
They hushed. Rideout closed his eyes. His lips moved silently. 20 seconds ticked past on Cat's watch, then 30. Her hands were damp with perspiration. She wiped them one at a time on her sweater, then took hold of the broom again. We look like people gathered at a deathbed, she thought. Outside, the wind snarled along the gutters. Rideout opened his eyes and leaned close to Newsom.
God, there is an evil outsider in this man. An outsider feeding on his flesh and bones. Help me cast it out. As your son cast out the demons from the possessed man of the Gadarenes, help me speak to the little green god of agony inside Andrew Newsom in your own voice of command.
He leaned closer. He curled the long fingers of one arthritis-swollen hand around the base of Newsom's throat as if he intended to strangle him. He leaned closer still and inserted the first 2 fingers of his other hand into the billionaire's mouth. He curled them and pulled down the jaw.
Come out, he said.
He had spoken of command, but his voice was soft, silky, almost cajoling. It made the skin on Cat's back and arms prickle.
Come out in the name of Jesus. Come out in the names of all the saints and martyrs. Come out in the name of God. Who gave you leave to enter and now commands you to leave? Come out into the light. Leave off your gluttony and come out.
There was nothing.
Come out in the name of Jesus. Come out in the names of the saints and martyrs.
His hands flexed slightly, and Newsom's breath began to rasp.
No, don't go deeper. You can't hide, you small evil. Come out into the light. Jesus commands you. The saints and martyrs command you. God commands you to leave off dining on this man and come out.
A cold hand gripped Cat's upper arm and she almost screamed. It was Melissa. Her eyes were huge, her mouth hung open. In Cat's ear, the housekeeper's whisper was as harsh as sandpaper.
Look!
A bulge, like a goiter, had appeared in Newsom's throat, just above Rideout's loosely grasping hand. It began to move slowly mouthward. Cat had never seen anything like it in her life.
That right,
Rideout almost crooned. His face was streaming with sweat. The collar of his shirt had gone limp and dark.
Come out! Come out into the light! You've done your feeding, you small thing of darkness!
The wind rose to a scream. Rain that was now half sleet blasted the windows like shrapnel. The lights flickered and the house creaked.
The God that let you in commands you to leave. Jesus commands you to leave. Oh, the saints and the martyrs!
He let go of Newsom's mouth, pulling his hand back the way a man does when he's touched something hot. But Newsom's mouth stayed open. More, it began to widen, first into a gape and then into a soundless howl. His eyes rolled back in his head and his feet began to jitter. His urine let go and the sheet over his crotch went as dark as Rideout's sweaty collar.
Stop! Cat said, starting forward. He's having a seizure! You have to
Jensen yanked her back. She turned to him and saw his normally ruddy face had gone as pale as a linen napkin. Newsom's jaw had dropped all the way to his breastbone. The lower half of his face disappeared into a mighty yawn. Cat heard temporomandibular tendons creak as knee tendons did during strenuous physical therapy, a sound like dirty hinges. The lights in the room stuttered off, on, off, then on again.
Come out! Rideout shouted. Come out!
In the darkness behind Newsom's teeth, a bladder-like thing rose. It was pulsing. There was a rending, splintering crash, and the window across the room shattered. Coffee cups fell to the floor and broke. Suddenly there was a branch in the room with them. The lights went out. The generator started up again. No burp this time, but a steady roar. When the lights came back on, Rideout was lying on the bed with Newsom, his arms flung out and his face planted on the wet patch in the sheet. Something was oozing from Newsom's gaping mouth, his teeth dragging grooves in its shapeless body, which was stippled with stubby green spikes.
Not a tennis ball, Cat thought. More like one of those couches the kids play with.
Tanya saw it and fled back down the hall with her head hunched forward, her hands locked at the nape of her neck and her forearms over her ears. The green thing tumbled onto Newsom's chest.
Spray it! Cat screamed at Jensen. Spray it before it can get away!
Yes, then they would put it in the specimen bottle and screw the lid down tight, very tight. Jensen's eyes were huge and glassy. He looked like a sleepwalker. Wind blew through the room. It swirled his hair. A picture fell from the wall. Jensen pistoned out the hand holding the can of pepper spray and triggered the plastic nub. There was a hiss. Then he leaped to his feet, screaming. He tried to turn, probably to flee after Tanya, but stumbled and fell to his knees. Although Cat felt too dumbfounded to move, to even stir a hand, part of her brain must still have been working, because she knew what had happened. He had gotten the can turned around, and instead of pepper spraying the thing that was now oozing through the unconscious Reverend Rideout's hair, Jensen had sprayed himself.
Don't let it get me,
Jensen shrieked. He began to crawl blindly away from the bed.
I can't see. Don't let it get me.
The wind gusted. Dead leaves tore free of the tree branch that had come through the window and swirled around the room. The green thing dropped from the nape of Rideout's creased and sunburned neck onto the floor. Feeling like a woman underwater,
Cat swiped at it with the bristle end of the broom. She missed. The thing disappeared under the bed, not rolling, but slithering. Jensen crawled headfirst into the wall beside the doorway.
Where am I? I can't see!
Newsom was sitting up, looking bewildered.
What's going on? What happened?
He pushed Rideout's head off him. The Reverend slid bonelessly from the bed to the floor. Melissa bent over him.
Don't do that!
Cat shouted, but it was too late. She didn't know if the thing was truly a god or just some weird kind of leech, but it was fast. It shot out from under the bed, rolled along Rideout's shoulder, onto Melissa's hand and up her arm. Melissa tried to shake it off and couldn't. Some kind of sticky stuff on those stubby little spikes. The part of Cat's brain that would still work told the part, the much larger part, that still wouldn't. Like the glue on a fly's feet. Melissa had seen where the thing came from, and even in her panic, was wise enough to cover her own mouth with both hands. The thing skittered up her neck, over her cheek, and squatted on her left eye. The wind screamed, and Melissa screamed with it. It was the cry of a woman drowning in a kind of pain the 1 to 10 charts in hospitals can never describe. Melissa's agony was well over 100, that of someone being boiled alive. She staggered backwards, clawing at the thing on her eye. It was pulsing faster now, and Cat could hear a low, liquid sound as the thing resumed feeding. It was a slushy sound. It doesn't care who it eats, Cat thought. She realized she was walking toward the screaming, flailing woman.
Hold still, Melissa! Hold still!
Melissa paid no attention. She continued to back up. She struck the thick branch now visiting the room and went sprawling. Cat dropped to one knee beside her and brought the broom handle smartly down on Melissa's face, down on the thing that was feeding on Melissa's eye. There was a splatting sound, and suddenly the thing was sliding limply down the housekeeper's cheek, leaving a wet trail of slime behind. It moved across the leaf-littered floor, intending to hide under the branch the way it had hidden under the bed. Cat sprang to her feet and stepped on it. She felt it splatter beneath her sturdy New Balance walking shoe. Green stuff shot out in both directions, as if she had stepped on a balloon filled with snot. Cat went down again, this time on both knees, and took Melissa in her arms. At first, Melissa struggled, and Cat felt a fist graze her ear. Then Melissa subsided, breathing harshly.
Is it gone, Cat? Is it gone?
I feel better,
Newsom said wonderingly from behind them in some other world.
Yes, it's gone, Cat said.
She peered into Melissa's face. The eye the thing had landed on was bloodshot, but otherwise, it looked all right.
Can you see? Yes, it's blurry, but clearing. Cat, the pain. It was like the end of the world. Somebody needs to flush my eyes, Jensen yelled.
He sounded indignant.
Flush your own eyes, Newsom said cheerily. You've got 2 good legs, don't you? I think I might too once Cat throws them back into gear. Somebody check on Rideout. I think the poor son of a bitch might be dead.
Melissa was staring up at Cat, one eye blue, the other red, and leaking tears.
The pain, Cat. You have no idea of the pain.
Yes, Cat said.
Actually, I do, now.
She left Melissa sitting by the branch and went to Rideout. She checked for a pulse and found nothing, not even the wild waver of a heart that is still trying its best. Rideout's pain, it seemed, was over. The generator went out.
Fuck, Newsom said, still sounding cheery. I paid $70,000 for that piece of Jap shit.
I need someone to flush my eyes, Jensen bellowed. Cat!
Cat opened her mouth to reply, then didn't. In the new darkness, something had crawled onto the back of her hand.
For Russ Doerr. Cookie Jar, read by Santino Fontana.
One. There was a certain accord between them right from the beginning. The boy thought the old man looked pretty good for 90, and the old man thought the boy, whose name was Dale, looked pretty good for 13. The kids started by calling him great-grandpa, but Barrett was having none of that. It makes me feel even older than I am. Call me Rhett. That's what my father called me. I was a Rhett before there was a Rhett Butler. Imagine that. Dale asked him who Rhett Butler was. Never mind. It was a bad book and only a so-so movie. Tell me again about this project of yours. We're supposed to talk to our oldest relative and ask what life was like when he was my age. Then I'm supposed to write a 2-page report on how much things have changed. But Mr. Kendall hates generalities, so I'm supposed to concentrate on one or two specifics. That means I know what specifics are, Rhett said. Which specifics have he got in mind? Dale considered the question. While he did so, Rhett considered the boy. Healthy mop of hair, straight back, clear skin and eyes. There were 77 years between them, and Dale Alderson probably considered that an ocean. But to Rhett, it was only a lake. Maybe no more than a pond. You'll get across it in no time, kiddo, he thought. The brevity of the swim between your bank and mine will surprise you. It certainly surprised me. He wasn't sure his great-grandson, the youngest of the lot, even thought of him as an actual human being, more like a talking fossil. Speak up, Dale. I've got all day, but you probably don't. Well, you remember before there was TV, right? Rhett smiled. Even though he felt this was a question to which his great-grandson should already have known the answer, he restrained an urge to say, "Don't they teach you kids anything?" Because it would have been curmudgeonly and impolite, not to mention ungrateful. This boy had come to the Good Life Retirement Home for the sole purpose of hearing Barrett Alderson talk about the past, a subject that usually had kids running the other way as fast as they could go. It was only for a school assignment, true, but still. He had come all the way across town on the bus, which made Rhett think of trips he and his brother Jack had made on the interurban line to see their mother. Dale, I never even saw a television until I was 21. Radar scopes, yes, but no TVs. I had my first confirmed sighting in an appliance store window after I got back from the war. I watched for 20 minutes, almost hypnotized. Which war was that? 2, he said patiently. Nazis, Hitler, Japanese in the Pacific, ring any bells? Sure, yeah. Bonsai charges and all that. I thought you might mean Korea. When Korea blew up, I was married with a couple of kids. Was my grandpa one of them? Yep. He just made his appearance. And when Vietnam rolled around, I was as old as your father is now. Maybe older. So you were stuck with radio, huh? Well, yes, but we didn't consider ourselves stuck with it. Outside his room, from down the hall, came the electronically amplified voice of the retirement home's recreation director, or one of her minions, calling out bingo numbers. Rhett was happy not to be there, although he supposed he would be there tomorrow. He was measuring out the last years of his life, maybe down to months now, considering the blood that had started to show up in the bowl when he took a shit. Not in coffee spoons, but in coverall games. No? Dale asked. Absolutely not. After supper, my dad and my brothers would— Wait, hold that thought. Dale dug into the pocket of his jeans and brought out an iPhone. He fiddled with it, and the screen lit up. He fiddled with it some more, and then set it on the bed. That thing records, too? Red asked. Uh-huh. Is there anything it doesn't do? Honey, it don't do windows, the boy said, and Red laughed. The kid might be a little foggy on 20th century history, but he was quick and funny. Dale smiled back at his great-grandfather, glad the old guy had gotten the joke. Perhaps seeing him as a human being after all, or beginning to. Rhett could hope. Even at 90, he remained mostly optimistic, although optimism was a little harder to manage at 3 a.m, lying awake and feeling the threads holding him to this life-loosening. Are you sure it's hearing me? Yeah, this baby's got great pickup. Also, I can see your voice on the screen. He held it up. Say something. Our radio was a Philco table model, Rhett said, and watched sound waves roll across the iPhone screen. See? Yes. Great gadget. Don't know how we ever got along without him. Dale checked the old man's face to be sure he was kidding. Good one, great-grandpa. No, good one, Rhett. Good one, Rhett. So, tell me about the radio. Rhett talked for 10 minutes or so, about how he and his two brothers would lie on the living room rug after supper, then with their schoolbooks, his father in his easy chair with his feet up on the hassock, smoking his pipe, all of them listening to the Philco. He told Dale about The Shadow and the Jack Benny program, how Jack was such a cheapskate, and his own favorite, Major Bo's Amateur Hour, where the host would hurry talkie guests along by saying, all right, and bang a gong if their performances were bad. But he began to slow down as more vivid memories slipped into the flow of his recollections. Those bus rides with Jack, for instance. And he thought, why not tell him? You have never told anyone, and you'll be dead soon enough. Blood in the toilet does not lie. Not when you're 90. That amateur show is really sponsored by cigarettes? Dale asked. Yep, Old Golds. If you want a treat instead of a treatment, smoke Old Golds. They're good for you. They could really say that? The boy's eyes were shining with fascination. They did, but let's forget about the radio shows. I want to tell you something else I remember. Okay, but those old radio shows are pretty interesting. I can tell you something a lot more interesting, but turn off your gadget. I don't want you recording this. Really? Really. Dale turned off his iPhone and put it back in his pocket. He looked at his great-grandfather with some caution now, as if Rhett were about to tell him he'd robbed a few banks or enjoyed setting dogs on fire as a teenager. I had sort of a peculiar childhood, Dale, because my mother was peculiar. Not outright crazy, at least not crazy enough to be locked away in a sanitarium, but very, very peculiar. I was the youngest of three. In 1927, 2 years after I was born, she moved out of the house, bag and baggage, and into a little cottage on the other side of town. This side of town, in fact. And not far from here, although there's a shopping center there now. The place was hers by inheritance from an old aunt, and not much bigger than a garage. She left my father to raise Pete, Jack, and me, which he did, with the help of a woman who came in to do the housekeeping and watch us when we were too small to be trusted on our own. She never even gave a reason, Dale asked. Said it was for our own protection. My father saw she had a good allowance for her necessaries, and he did it without complaint. Those were tough times. But he had a shirt and tie job with the American Eagle Insurance Company, and her wants were small. They maintained a collegial relationship. Do you know what that means? That they got along? That's exactly right, and good for you. My brother Jack and I got along with her, too. accepted the situation the way young kids usually do, without much complaining or too many questions. We went to visit her quite often. We'd play gin rummy and crazy eights and Monopoly. The place was cold in the winter and hotter than a stovepipe in the summer, even with a fan blowing the air around. We had a lot of laughs. She had a ukulele. Sometimes the three of us went out on the back stoop and she'd play and we'd sing. Stuff like Old Black Joe and Masses in the Cold, Cold Ground. Those were real songs? Dale glanced at his iPhone. Probably wishing it was still turned on, Rhett thought. Too bad, kid, but you're not playing this for anybody. Crazy is safer when it goes unrecorded. Real songs. Not very politically correct by today's standards, but that was a different time. A different world, really. We loved her like mad. She was energetic, as manic depressives often are. Her laughter was free and wild. It was different with Pete. He was the oldest, almost 7 when she moved out, and he stayed angry at her until she died. Wouldn't visit her unless my dad made him, which he eventually gave up doing. Then broke down at her funeral, Rhett thought. Cried so hard he fainted and had to be carried outside into the fresh air to revive. Probably his feelings were hurt, Dale said. Maybe he even thought he was to blame for her leaving. Rhett smiled. You're a wise child, son. I'm sure it was all of that and more. In any case, he rarely saw her. Jack and I, though, we didn't just love her. We were fascinated by her. 1936 was her last good year. Jack was 13 and I was 11, which made us old enough to ride across town on the interurban. So we went to see her once or twice a week, usually on Saturdays, sometimes after school. My mom told me not to ask about yours, Dale said. Because she committed suicide? Yeah. Mom said she might just be a, like, historical figure to me, but she was a lot more to you. When she asks me how it went, and she will, I'll have to tell her you brought it up. That's fine, Rhett said. And it did hurt. It hurt plenty. I guess it most always does when your mother dies, but suicide is in a class by itself. It hit Jack harder than it did me, because he blamed himself. He thought that because he was older, he should have seen how much worse she was getting. Only it was hard to see because she was so full of life and so interesting. She'd fly around that place, getting cards or board games or 500-piece Tuco puzzles for the three of us to do. Sometimes she'd crank up her Victrola and try to teach us how to dance the Charleston. And when we wouldn't, she'd do it by herself, with her shadow on the wall. She'd tell jokes, play her uke, show us how to do magic tricks like the disappearing coin and the floating handkerchief. And, this is important, she had a big blue ceramic jar on a high shelf with cookies on the side in red. It was always full, and we'd eat them until we were stuffed. All different kinds, all good. That place of hers might not have been much bigger than a garage, but we had plenty of fun there. She saw to it, and I'm not sure even an adult could have seen the truth under all that camouflage. What truth? Dale asked. That she was getting worse. She'd chat away about other worlds right next to ours and the alien races that lived there, and how something was out to get her. It talked to her through the electrical sockets, she said. So she unscrewed all the light bulbs at night and put playing cards over the plug-in plates on the floor. She said the celluloid backs on the cards were very effective at stopping that voice, only then she'd laugh, like it was all a big joke. Whew, Dale said. Far out. She drew a map on one of the walls, and she was always adding to it. She said it was a country in one of those other worlds. She called it Lalenka, and said it was full of entities. Do you know what that means? Dale shook his head. creatures that wanted to come through into our world but couldn't. At least not yet. They were bottled up by some restraining force, which was a good thing, because they were hungry. She said that if they ever got into our world, they'd eat everything. Not just the people and the animals, but lawns and cars and buildings and even the sky. About other things, though, she was completely rational. She did her little bit of grocery shopping. She kept herself clean and neat. She was very affectionate with me and Jack, and she never failed to ask about Pete. Before we left, she always told us to tell him that he was welcome any time. I only moved out because it wouldn't have been safe for you boys and your father if I stayed, she said. That's amazing. Rhett shrugged and spread his liver-spotted hands. Not to us, it wasn't. We just accepted it. That's what children do, Dale. But her map, that was amazing. In the last year of her life, there were new things on it every time we visited. Mountain ranges, lakes, villages, castles, forests, roads. Did your dad ever see it? Oh, yes, many times. He thought it was a genuine work of art and said it should have been in a gallery someplace. I think he believed that map was one of the few things keeping her on the rails, along with our visits, of course. These days, I suppose some people, smart people, would call it a coping mechanism. Sometimes we just sit in her little kitchen, eating sandwiches with the crusts cut off, and she'd ask us about school, and our friends, and quiz us if we had a test coming up. Jack was taking algebra and didn't get it, but she explained it to him by using cookies from the cookie jar. She'd draw an equals sign on a sheet of paper and put 3 cookies from the jar on one side and 7 on the other. Next to the 3 cookies, she'd put an X and tell Jack to stack more cookies on top of it until both sides of the equals sign were the same. Huh. Cool. But in between those rational, normal things, she'd tell us about what was going on in Lalanka, where the gobbets, those were creatures who lived in the deep woods, were producing a terrible white mist that killed small animals and gave larger ones convulsions. Or the war between Red Henry and his renegade twin brother, Black John. One day when we came, she'd colored the woods around the biggest castle, Red Henry's castle, black. Because, she said, Black John had put the torch to the long forest. And there was the stuff about how time had come to a stop in the West Kingdoms, and it was tearing holes in the fabric of existence. If the time stop spreads to our world, boys, we're doomed, she said. I had nightmares about it. I'm not surprised, Dale said. I probably would, too. She called the white mist Forza, and said it could travel in electric wires and telephone lines if it ever got over here. I had nightmares about that, too, and I got in the habit of checking our telephone to make sure Forza wasn't coming out of the holes in the receiver, only... He trailed off. Only what? I don't know how much of that she actually believed, Rhett said finally. Back then, I believed that she believed. Do you get that? Dale said he did. And because she believed, we believed. But Jack changed his mind after she was dead, and he convinced me. He said Lalanka was just a story she made up to distract her from one specific thing. Something that was real, but not a part of this world. Something that couldn't be, but was. He said he didn't think a person could live with something like that. He called it a hole in reality. Lalanka and the gobbets, Red Henry and Black John, the Forza Mist, they were just distractions. A way to cover that hole in reality the way you might cover a well with boards so no one would fall in. He thought about it and added, What I mean is those stories, were her way of staying sane. At least that's what Jack thought. I came to believe different. Are you serious? Dale's eyes were shining. As a heart attack, kiddo. Anyway, all her distractions finally stopped working. Her uke, dancing with her shadow, the map on the wall, the playing cards over the wall sockets. Her stories stopped working for her, too. Because the thing she was afraid of was in the house with her all along. What? What was she afraid of? She was afraid of the cookie jar. 2. After his wife's funeral, George Alderson told his three sons that he was going to empty the little house to the walls, sell what could be sold, and throw away the rest. But before he did it, he took them there and invited each of them to take one thing to remember her by. Jack chose the ukulele and eventually learned to play it. Peter, a much quieter and less argumentative boy in the wake of his mother's untimely death, took the watch George had given her when she left for the little cottage. It was a man's watch, and she had worn it around her neck like a ticking locket. Rhett took the blue ceramic cookie jar. He kept it under his bed, and each night he and Jack ate a couple of the cookies. To remember her by, Rhett said. Pete was not invited in to share this ritual, and did not even know about it, because by then he had his own room. Although neither of the younger boys said so aloud, they felt Pete had no right to share in their cookie communion. He had mourned their mother after she was dead, strenuously, but had mostly turned his back on her while she was alive, sneering at the playing cards propped over the baseboard outlets, and calling the map of Lolenka goofy shit. He loved her, Rhett told his great-grandson, but we felt he didn't love her enough. We were just kids, remember, and kids can be awfully judgmental. He paused, thinking. Although in some ways, I still think we were right. 3. There came a night, it might have been a week after Moira Alderson's suicide, it might have been 2, when Rhett and Jack Alderson shared a realization that should have come earlier, and would have, if their powers of observation hadn't been numbed by grief. They were sitting on Rhett's bed, the cookie jar between them. "Whoa, Nellie," Jack said. "It's still full. How can that be?" Rhett had no idea, but it was true. They had taken a lot of cookie communion since their mother's death, but the jar was still packed to the rim. On this particular night, the ones on top were macaroons. When Rhett stirred them aside, he saw chocolate chippers beneath. He started to burrow deeper to see if he could find the oatmeal raisin cookies that were his personal favorites, but Jack grabbed his wrist and pulled his hand out. "Don't do that." "Why not?" "Because it might be dangerous. Put the cover back on and stick it under your bed." Rhett did so without argument, and Jack put out the light. They lay there in silence for a while, neither sleepy. Rhett could feel the cookie jar underneath him, a small, dense planet with its own gravitational pull. "It's like her ghost is in there," Rhett said finally, and his eyes filled with the tears that were always waiting since their mother had died. "It's not her ghost. That's stupid," Jack said. Rhett could tell from the thickness of his voice that his brother was crying too. "What then? Is it something to do with Lolenka? The Forza? The—" It was hard to finish because they were what he feared the most. "The gobbets?" "Santa Claus isn't real, and neither are the gobbets or the Forza Mist, Rhett. None of that jazz is real. The map was just made up out of her head." Jack was trying to sound tough, but his voice was still thick. "She knew it, too. It was all just stuff she made up to keep her mind off the cookie jar." "Then what's in there?" "Cookies. And I don't want any more. I never want to eat another cookie in my life. Not from that jar, and not even from the bakery." 4. A week passed. The cookie jar stayed under Rhett's bed with the lid on. Then one night, It was a Saturday. Rhett was jerked back from the edge of sleep by the sound of his brother crying. Jack? Rhett sat up. What's wrong?
We would have gone over there today, Jack said. We would have had bacon sandwiches and played board games. I miss her. I miss Mom.
I miss her too. Jack got out of bed, ghostly in his white pajamas, and sat down next to Rhett.
I was thinking of how her place smelled. How good it smelled.
Like cookies, Rhett said. That's how it always smelled. It was like a fairy tale house that way, wasn't it?
Yes,
Jack said. Only she was a good witch instead of a bad one. They sat there for a little while, not talking, remembering the smell and her shadow dancing on the wall. How gone she was had finally gotten through to them. Even the map was gone, with the long forest and Lookout Hill and Castle Black and Castle Red. Their father might have said it belonged in a gallery when she was alive, but when she was gone, he scrubbed it away like a shopkeeper scrubbing a dirty word off the front of his store so his customers wouldn't be offended. He certainly couldn't sell the house with that crazy thing on the wall, he told the boys. It had to go. He took pictures of it first, but Kodak snaps weren't the same. Couldn't be.
Get the jar, Jack said.
Rhett pulled it out from under the bed with relief and cradled it in his lap. Jack lifted the cover. It was still full to the brim, but it was no longer macaroons on top. That Saturday night, it was ginger snaps. She's been gone almost a month, Jack said. They'll be stale. But they weren't stale. They were as fresh as if they had been baked that very day. Moira had cut her wrists and died in the bathtub on a hot August afternoon. Rhett and Jack discovered the cookie jar was always full right around the time school let in again. Halloween came, and Rhett went trick-or-treating by himself for the first time. He dressed as a pirate and came home with a bag of candy, but it wasn't very much fun without Jack, who had declared himself too old to put on a costume and go traipsing around the neighborhood begging for sweets. Thanksgiving came, and their father, now showing strands of gray at his temples, carved the turkey. Pete's girlfriend ate with them, and Pete ate with her family at Christmas. They became engaged on Valentine's Day of 1939. Shortly after Pete turned 18. Summer came again, and Rhett spent most of it at the vacant lot down the street playing baseball. Sometimes he pitched, even when there were bigger kids on the team. He had a great fastball. Jack occasionally watched him, but rarely played. Mostly he went places by himself, usually with a sketch pad under his arm. He had inherited his mother's artistic ability and then some.
He might have been one of the great ones, Rhett told Dale. Probably not. Most kids never fulfill their potential, but we'll never know.
The lives of the two younger boys began to draw apart, slowly and subtly, but surely. Yet they still shared the same room. At night they took cookie communion, and the blue ceramic jar was always full. The cookies inside, always fresh. Sometimes they were chocolate-covered grams. Sometimes they were sugar cookies. Sometimes they were macaroons or chocolate chippers. They ate one or two apiece, sitting on Rhett's bed. More than 1,000 cookies in the course of that long year, before Pete got married and Jack moved into Pete's room. By then, Hitler had begun to dominate the news. And it seemed that in each day's paper, more of the map on the front page was stamped with Nazi swastikas. Europe was pretty much gone, and England would be next.
It can't hold out, George Alderson said, puffing his pipe.
There were only two boys listening to the Philco table model with him now. Pete was living 9 blocks away with his new wife, and on the road most of the time selling beer and cigarettes and stocking jukeboxes with new records.
Thank God there's a long stretch of ocean between us and the maniac with the mustache.
As the swastikas on the front page map continued to spread, Britain still holding out but Russia tottering, Rhett thought often of his mother's map. Hitler is really Black John, he thought, and he's turning Europe into Lalenka. And one day,
while Rhett was downtown shopping for Christmas presents, a shopkeeper told him that the Japs had bombed Pearl Harbor. "How old were you then?" Dale asked him.
16. I still hadn't kissed a girl.
Could you sign up to fight if you were 16?
No. I just hoped the war would last long enough for me to get in. And unfortunately, it did.
5. Moira Alderson had sometimes called her oldest the plotter of the family. Slow and steady wins the race. But Pete was Speedy Alka-Seltzer after Pearl Harbor. He was at the Navy recruiting office the very next day, with a fresh haircut and wearing his best suit. His new wife encouraged him, feeling he would be safer on board a big battleship than fighting the Japs hand-to-hand in the Pacific. On the day he left for Newport News, Pete gave Jack the Bulova watch their mother had worn around her neck, with instructions to keep it safe.
"Because I'll want it back when I come home," he said.
Jack, the artistic one, joined the USAAF in early 1942, as soon as he turned 18. On the day before he left for Florida, where he would learn to fly the P-47 Thunderbolt at Hillsborough Army Airfield, he gave the wristwatch to Rhett.
"What about the Uke?" Rhett asked him.
"Never mind the Uke, greedy guts. I'm taking that with me. You just wear the watch and keep it wound. It won't keep good time if you don't." Rhett promised he would. They were sitting on his bed and ate 2 cookies apiece from the blue jar. It was still full, and the cookies, gingerbread that night, were as tasty as ever. Rhett enlisted in the Army 1.5 years later, 1 step ahead of the draft. There was no excitement in the thought of going to war, no thrill, only pessimism so strong it amounted to a premonition. He felt sure that he would be sent overseas, and that when the inevitable invasion happened, perhaps in 1944, perhaps not until 1945 or 46, he would be in the first wave and killed by enemy machine gun fire before he could even wade out of the water. He could actually see his body rocking back and forth in the waves, face down, arms splayed. It was in this fatalistic frame of mind that on his last night home,